96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. Your questions or comments, toll free at 855-288-4876. Now, Insight.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we talk to a political pioneer, a man who made history, who made Virginia, indeed America, stand up and take notice. Douglas Wilder was the first African-American elected to the office of governor in this country, and he did it in arguably an unlikely place, the Commonwealth of Virginia. He joins me in studio to talk about his new autobiography, Son of Virginia, A Life in America's Political Arena. As always, lines are open. You can give us a call at 202-319-7810. That's 202-319-7810. Outside of the D.C. calling area, 855-288-4876, 855-288-4876. However, we do invite you to listen, as this is a rare opportunity to hear from an icon. Governor, thank you so much for coming in.
It's good to be here with you, and I've enjoyed it a great deal.
Oh, it really is an honor to have you here.
Thank you, sir.
Your first autobiography.
Yes, first book I've ever written.
Why now? Why the first book? You've done so much.
Well, thank you for that. But I've been encouraged by a lot of people to do some writing. And I kept saying, I'm going to get to it. I'm going to do it. And then it dawned on me about a year or two ago. Hey, look, old buddy, if you don't hurry up and get to it, you won't be here to do it. And mm-hmm. So consequently, I felt that to the extent that I have had experiences that I would share with others and to hopefully provide some degree of guidelines as to some of the things it takes and some of the things I've seen, I thought I should do it now. And to that extent, I chose to start the book and finish it. And I feel this way about it. It's more about the people than it is about me, because I couldn't elect myself.
Mm-hmm.
People had to have the confidence in me to do it. I like what you said earlier, one of the more unlikely places, Virginia. And yet, let's look back at it. Virginia was the place where the country was founded, in mm-hmm. Jamestown. Virginia was the place where the British were defeated, in Yorktown. Look, in Virginia, it was where Lee laid down his arms in Appomattox. And so Richmond produced someone that said, you can be the governor, even though your grandparents were slaves. And so it's almost automatic, in my judgment, as well as axiomatic, that Virginia continues to have been and continues to possibly be a leader in America. We waited 17 years, and fortunately, my good friend Deval Patrick mm-hmm. from Massachusetts was elected governor. And I said, you know, Deval, I waited a long time for you to get here. You almost didn't make it, old buddy, while mm-hmm. I could see it. And I said to him then, I said, but you know, Massachusetts has always followed Virginia. He didn't like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would imagine that he would not have liked that. But don't you think it is ironic that when you look at history, that the heart or seat of the Confederacy would eventually elect the first black man to the highest position in the state? Even when it happened, I found it fascinating.
Well, let me tell you, though, it's a testament to the people of Virginia. Lots of people don't know that the smallest concentration of African Americans of any of the southern states is in Virginia, population-wise and voting population-wise. The voting population of African Americans in Virginia is about 14% to 15%. And so I had to obviously have the support of any numbers of other people. I went to stay in places in Southwest Virginia,
mm-hmm.
down where Tennessee and Kentucky meet, and There were those who said, Wilder's wasting his time. He's a fool going out there with those people. I never stayed in any hotels. I always stayed in the homes of the people that I met. I never campaigned on main roads. I always campaigned on the back roads and the country stores. And I stayed in those people's homes. They got a chance to see me up close.
Retail politics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to that extent, I think it's an attestation to the people of Virginia that they saw in me a person that could provide leadership rather than a person of color.
We're talking to Governor Douglas Wilder, the first African-American elected to the office of governor in this country, of course, the former governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He has penned a new autobiography, Son of Virginia, A Life in America's Political Arena. There's so much in this book. An unlikely state, and you said just now that some people say, well, gosh, maybe he's a fool, maybe he's crazy. was there ever a point, I mean, you were lieutenant governor beforehand,
yeah.
So certainly some would say training ground, and you had held office before, obviously.
Yeah.
But when you decided to run for governor, did it give you pause, or were you just sure that you were just ready for this? Was this your time?
Well, I appreciate your reminding the audience that I had been in the state Senate for 16 years. I had never had opposition once I was elected. I chaired any numbers of committees. I chaired the committee that even would assign other senators to serve on committees. And so that degree of confidence was reposed in me in that body. And then when I ran for lieutenant governor, and when I went out and started meeting people, I carried Southwest Virginia. And for a Democrat mm-hmm. to carry Southwest Virginia, I'm not talking about Roanoke. I'm talking about down where Kentucky and Tennessee and Virginia all meet. And when people got a chance to see me and talk to me and hear me and look at my record in terms of accountability, I never wanted anybody to vote for me based on the color of my skin, but I said, don't vote against me because of that. I don't want my race, my color, to be a badge nor a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
If there are things that I'm producing and not showing, tell me what they are. If there are things that are consonant with what you think, let me know what they are because I'm here to represent the people, who all of the people. And it resonated. Consequently, when I ran for governor, I never had any doubt that I could win and that I would win always is up to the numbers of people who turn out and vote for you. And I am disappointed that since my election, we've not had an African-American to win a statewide race.
And I want to talk to you about that a little bit later in the conversation. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, outside of the D.C. calling area, 855-288-4876, 855-288-4876. Of course, we are talking to Governor Douglas Wilder, the first African-American elected to the office in America. Of course, he was governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Let me go to the phone lines quickly. Scott calling from Northwest D.C. Scott, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, it's really nice to be talking to two very good shop guys. My question is to you, Governor.
Yes, sir.
What do you think of the mounting violence that's going on? Because you were literally a sneeze away from being our first African-American president. But the violence that has taken place, the exposure of police brutality, all has taken place under Barack Obama. What do you think of the nature of that, and what would be your opinion of it now?
Well, first of all, I'm horrified by it. I think that we have not addressed it as a nation. I think that we are more caught up with, oh, we've got to get these terrorists who are coming here to kill us. And yet, if you look at the statistics for the past 10 years or 11 years, you'll see that there may have been about 200 killings, really, that are directly related to the terrorists. In that period of time, there have been over 400,000 homicides in America. 400,000 plus homicides, the majority of whom have been what? African Americans. Nobody's upset about it anywhere. You name that community that's saying, hey, enough is enough. You name either politicians and say, no, we're not gonna have this. We can't have our communities distraught by this. And so it's not a question of rising to the last minute and saying, well, you know, Black Lives Matter. Lives have mattered all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When I took over as mayor of the city of Richmond, a homicide was out off the skies, and we're not going to have this. Luckily, I had a police chief that we got from D.C., Rodney Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
And he came down there, and we had what involved what we call community policing. Police would go into the communities. I used to go around with him on occasions. Police people would come out and greet the police. Hey, hello, how you doing, chief? What's going on? Because he had established that type of relationship. Rather than to call for 911 or something or the chief of police for your problem, call that guy in your neighborhood, because we allowed them to take their cars home and live in the neighborhood with the people. That's been changed a bit since I stopped being mayor. But it's that type of understanding that you have got to show that police are a part of the community as well. You are not ever going to have enough police in this country to control it if the people don't accept the law.
Hmm.
And to the extent that they have continued to accept the law, and let's hope they continue to do so, these continued killings are not going to go as they're going without some unfortunate responses to them.
Why didn't you run for president?
I did one time. I had about, I'd been in office a couple of years, and I predicted that there would be an opportunity for a Southerner and a Southern governor to be elected president. That was in 1992. And lo and behold, who was out there with me at the time? Bill Clinton.
Hmm.
And we chatted and we talked. The people in my state hated the idea that I was running for president because Virginia is the only state in the country that has 1 4-year term.
Okay.
You can't succeed yourself. They are saying, hey, look, we want you here. We ask you to be here. We support you for being here. The loudest applause I ever got was when I addressed the joint session of the General Assembly in December. I started running in September, and I dropped out in December.
Okay.
the loudest applause I got when I said, I am no longer a candidate for president of the United States. I said, yay, yay, yay. But Bill Clinton,
yeah.
James Carville, has said, my dropping out of the race did more to help Bill Clinton win, even with Mario Cuomo dropping out.
I need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go back to the phone lines. Carol from Upper Marlboro, we will talk to you next. We are talking to a former Virginia governor, Douglas Wilder. He has a new book, an autobiography, Son of Virginia, A Life in America's Political Arena. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, outside of the D.C. calling area, 855-288-4876, 855-288-4876. Carol and Mike, you're next. Stay with us. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. Stand by.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are honored to have in studio with us former Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder, the first African American to ever be elected to the office of governor in this country. Of course, he was the former governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you have a question or comment for the governor, you can give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, outside of the D.C. calling area, 855-288-4876, 855-288-4876. Mike calling from Southeast Washington. Mike, go right ahead. What's on your mind?
Yes, first of all, thank you for taking my phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask the governor, what is his opinion on gentrification issues in major cities, like the District of Columbia, when there are so many poor and working poor families are basically being shown the doors? And, you know, I'd like to, you know, just get his opinion on these type of issues.
When you say shown the door, what do you mean?
What I mean by showing the door is like that this city is not, you know, being, a lot of people are not, can't be able to afford living in the city anymore because when developers come into the neighborhood, the rents go skyrocket high.
Well,
and the problem of not enough affordable housing that's not around anytime when they develop an area and there's no affordable housing, and, you know, you got a lot of people trying to raise the living wage up to $15 an hour. You're not going to be able to survive in D.C.
Well, I think I got your question. And I say this. It's not a D.C. problem by itself. It's a national problem because there is, has been developed a resegregation in mm-hmm. the housing market all over the country. And a lot of it has to do with money. But when you do that, you affect education because you're not going to have the best schools or the best maintained schools, I should put it. And people are not going to send their children to schools that are dilapidated and run down. And we need to accentuate the what I would call more involvement with the decision-making process. This is the thing I say in the book, Harold, that we should be a part of the decision-making process. Rather than to say this is where the housing is going to be, who said that? Well, why does it have to be there, and why can't and why shouldn't it be over here? And these are the reasons why it should be there. That's why the Planning Commission, that's why the city councils, that's why the state legislators all have got to be made to understand that these are the things that should be considered in the process. Look at the effects of what did take place. Look at the effects of what might take place. And if you want this, say that. But this is the result of it. Consequently, if you do that, you are not helping, but you're contributing to the problem of the lack of gentrification as you speak of it.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. I want to ask you about politics.
I might know a little bit about
just
that.
Just a little bit, yeah. Are Democrats and Republicans different now than they were when you first got into the business of politics? Is it still, is the rhetoric... Was it as visceral then as it is now? What has happened?
Very good question, Al. I like that. I would have Democrats and Republicans friends, and we would vote against each other's measures. We would vote sometimes for each other's measures. But there was no lack of civility. We would go to lunch afterwards. We would go to dinner. We would entertain each other in our homes with our families. But now it has become so distraught with personal gain and personal advancement and party advancement rather than people advancement. Why do you think Donald Trump and the outsiders, Ben Carson and Carla Fiorina, are doing as well as they're doing, or even some of the others that have not been mentioned? Because they are considered outsiders. They are not beholden to anyone as such, the public thinks. And consequently, it's not a matter of saying, you're the bad guy and I'm a good guy. There are no good guys in politics. I don't care what party it is. Because the good guys are the guys that don't regard people bad
mm-hmm.
or good, but they work together. And unfortunately, your question is so well put because the country is beset with that.
Mm-hmm.
If we had to say, well, what are we going to believe that's going to come out as a result of this session of Congress? What good are we going to, the people, benefit from? I couldn't tell you today to save my life. And you'd be hard put to do so yourself.
Which is exactly why I asked.
I know.
And certainly, I would imagine, the sage that you are, that's probably one of the best answers that I've had. Obviously, something you've thought about.
A great deal, and it bothers me a great deal, because how do we benefit?
Yeah.
We are paying, and I know there are going to be some people who are not going to like this, and we are paying a part-time Congress full-time salary. Every time you turn around, well, we got to take a vacation. We got to take our break. We got to go back to the public that elected us. Why are you going back? So we can get reelected. To do what? Are you improving things in education, in housing? Are you improving things with crime? Are you improving the quality of life? Do you still, don't you recognize that there is a race problem in America today that needs to be dealt with? If so, how do you do it? I'm putting a seminar on next week, a symposium in Richmond at the Wilder School of Government and Public Policy, saying what? Race in American society. Let's discuss it. Let's talk about it. People don't want to even acknowledge it. Well, we're in this post-racial period now. No, we ain't. We never have been. And unless we discuss it so I can find out what the real problems are in housing, in jobs, in employment. How can a guy get a job if as soon as he comes out, he says, well, no, you got a record. Yeah. How can I get rid of my record? Will I never get a job? Thank goodness 6,000 people were turned loose today because they felt that they were not violent criminals. We lock up more people than any country in the world, more homicides than any country in the world. Why? More guns than any place in the world.
Let me go to Mark. Mark calling from Manassas. Mark, thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the comments that the president made the other day as far as the shooting goes, and it was brilliant how he brought it up as far as, you know, comparing the amount of people killed by terrorists in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Compare that to the amount of, you know, homicides through gun violence. The only thing I would add, though, is if you want to look at it in that respect, then he would have to then start with Chicago and start with these areas who have strict, you know, gun laws on the books already. Chicago, D.C., Detroit, places like that, where it's very difficult to get a gun as far as the laws go. But that demonstrates nothing except that a sheet of paper can't stop a person from purchasing a firearm.
Yeah.
And it can't stop a person from getting the firearm if he really wants one.
Well, let me see, Mark, if the governor can briefly comment on your thoughts there.
Well, I'm glad he agrees with what I said, and I think the president likewise said it. If the country is all in an uproar over the numbers of persons who have been killed by terrorists or alleged to have been killed by terrorists, numbering some 200 people, when you compare that with 400,000 people who've been killed with homicides, and if we're not concerned about that, then why are we more concerned with the latter and lesser numbers of persons? Because it's not the numbers. It's obviously to whom it's done. And until we come to understand that guns don't kill people, people kill people, that by using guns, you can let a gun on the table by itself, it won't do it. I had a one gun a month bill in Virginia, and I can tell you crime went down. And I will never apologize for the fact that one gun a month, in my judgment, is enough for any single person to have. Why do you need more than that? Well, I want my First Amendment rights. Second Amendment rights. Second Amendment speaks to what? A militia.
Yeah.
And it's misinterpreted, and eventually the Supreme Court, hopefully, will see otherwise. But I am not against people owning guns. But how many do you need, for God's sake?
Always a question. Mark, thank you so much. Robert, calling from Northeast. Go right ahead.
Yes. Good evening. And thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My question is to the governor. Governor Wilder, it's my understanding that everyone knows that Governor McDonald was convicted of bribery.
Yeah.
And violating the public trust.
Yeah.
My question to the governor is that I believe I read somewhere in during the news accounts that Governor Wilder petitioned the court, the judge, and wrote a letter in support of Governor McDonald in hopes of reducing his sentence. And I think that my personal belief is that sends the wrong message, not only to the public, but to other politicians as well. And I just wanted to know his rationale for doing that, if he did it.
Well, first of all, it's in the book that we're speaking of here now. I was called upon as to whether I would testify on behalf of Governor McDonald relative to his sentencing. I never passed judgment as to whether he was guilty or not, and I don't pass judgment on it now. There are no laws in Virginia that would have convicted him. He was convicted under a federal statute, which I'm not questioning here. But the only thing I said to the judge and the court is, in this instance, the man who gave the testimony against him, a fellow named Johnny Williams, the feds were investigating him for any numbers of crimes. He turned state's evidence against McDonald. McDonald stood the trial, was convicted, and received 2 years' sentence. I have never said anything was wrong with that sentence. I have not participated with anything in addition to that. I did say this, that what happened to Johnny Williams, the guy who started all the trouble, and he got no time at all.
You haven't heard much about him.
You won't hear anymore.
Yeah.
And so I'm not, and I'm glad you made that question, asked that question. It doesn't send the wrong message to anyone to speak for tempering justice with mercy. And that's what I asked the court to do.
Mm. Robert, thank you so much. There was something in the book, and you mentioned, and let me say, this book is hypercurrent. There's a lot of history in it, but I mean, this book is really, really very, very current. You mentioned the Michael Brown situation in Ferguson. Talk to me about that and how it relates to you as a political sage, again, as I mentioned earlier.
Well, one of the problems there that bothered me was, there are any numbers of people in the St. Louis area that I know, smart people, good people. And when you look at a place like Ferguson with the composition of the people who live there, they had enough people to elect their own chief of police, their own Commonwealth attorney, their own prosecutor, and they didn't, for whatever reasons they chose. And it's not an issue of passing guilt or innocence on Michael Brown, because you and I didn't have the facts. But the process was flawed to the extent that even the Attorney General said there are certain things that needed to have been cleaned up. The same circumstance that took place in Brooklyn. When you see a man being shot in his back in mm-hmm. South Carolina and mm-hmm. killed, something is wrong. The system is broken, and it needs to be fixed.
When we come back, more about the book, which is fascinating. We're going to just take a little snippet or two. Not going to give it all away, but but certainly some very, very interesting passages here. We're talking to former Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. We continue our conversation with former Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder. Of course, he has published a new autobiography, Son of Virginia, A Life in America's Political Arena. Something else, and I mentioned earlier that this book is very, very current, but you talk a lot about the election of President Obama. You were leaving the office of mayor of Richmond. Mm-hmm. At the time that he was actually being sworn into office. Your thoughts about his election and his presidency. I mean, we could talk, you know, ad nauseum about that, certainly. But, your thoughts about the election and what has happened since then.
I was excited, and I was one of the first persons of election capacity to endorse him. I did that before many of the people on Hill did, before John Lewis did, before Jim Clyburn did. Most of those people were supporting Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And I said, I see in this man the qualifications. He's got the aspiration. And he presents me with the thinking that he really means what he says as it relates to hope and change. And so I endorsed him before Oprah Winfrey endorsed him.
That's saying something.
And so it's never that I didn't have the belief that he was going to make it and cut it. And I think even now, with the 3 years of this current presidency almost coming to an end, he still has an opportunity to do things. And I think it's always early to pass judgment on the legacy of an individual until that person's tenure has passed and you've had a chance to see what the sediment is that has come down. Now, having said that, there are those who are somewhat disappointed. My biggest disappointment, Harold, and I don't mind telling you, is that being a lawyer myself, recognizing what Thurgood Marshall did on the bench relative to educating the other justices on the bench, letting them know what the real deal is out there. You guys don't know. You're sitting up here in these black robes. And I felt that with Clarence Thomas being on the bench, who has already said he didn't feel it his responsibility, nor any of his kin to do so, to represent people of color or to even advocate in that regard. And there are any numbers of reasons why you could go into that. That I would have sworn that if the president had an opportunity to appoint a person of color, qualified person of color, that he could have done so. And he's had two opportunities to do so, and he hasn't. When I look at the choice of Loretta Lynch as the attorney general, capable, smart, qualified woman of color, why couldn't she have been one of those two Supreme Court justices? Mm. That has bothered me.
I asked you about politics earlier. What about race relations as a whole? You kind of touched on it a little bit. But when you look at the broad landscape, and I'm not talking about this post-racial stuff mm-hmm. that we hear, but you know, what do you believe has happened to America as we see this sharp-toothed fight about immigration? We see of a certain generation of people of color and white folks constantly in this political economic battle. What are we moving forward? Are we back to the future or forward to the past? What's going on?
We have never ever had a full and adequate and continuing discussion of race in America. Never. When you were coming up, it wasn't discussed. After you become a man, it hasn't been discussed. It was never discussed when I was a boy. When has it ever been discussed? So how can you resolve a problem and solve a problem if you don't recognize that there is a problem? And so when people speak about race, I've been reading something the other day that someone was saying that slavery really was about immigration.
Yeah, that story just came up just recently, yeah, and you talk about that issue
yes.
in the book. Share that with me, because that was a part of a fight that you were
yes,
involved
that,
with.
Saying in essence that, well, you know, when slaves came over here, it was not about slavery. It was really about immigration for labor, and that they needed work, and we brought them here, and absolutely, boom, 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 boom. What they failed to recognize that Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, from Virginia, a man who held the seat that I held, because he was a governor in Virginia, that he instituted the process of not raising slaves for labor, but breeding them to sell them to South Carolina, because the tobacco was gone in Virginia. The better tobacco was in the islands. But South Carolina had the cotton. So if you guys want some good labor, I got it for you. We'll breed them here in Virginia. So it was all about money. And race, for the most part in this country, has been about money. When we don't discuss it, it's not an issue as to whether we're qualified to hold office. We've held everyone that you can name. But the issue is, why do we have this divide? We're going to have a seminar at the Wilder School of Government on race in American society. We're going to have people to come and to speak. Hopefully, we can start this discussion. When you look at some of the things that are happening, youngster being put out of school, of color, of course, because he looked at some girl in his class.
This was in Ohio.
12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
he looked. Or to have someone said a 6-year-old boy was suspended from school because he held hands
with somebody in school. Now, look what you do to those kids' education. Look what you do to their lives.
What do you think that's about?
Race.
You think that's a, you think it is just
what else
purely
could it be about
race?
Do you know the whites that have been that has been done to? No. The things that have been characterized as things that we should get over and get beyond. The first chapter in the book is Carry Me Back. And I put that in there to show that was the official state song of Virginia.
Yes.
And people gave me hell.
About changing.
Literally hell. Yeah. Well, when I introduced it, I had been only elected for 2 months in the General Assembly. I'd been in the Senate for 2 months. Elected, rather, in December, and this was in February when I said, wait, I didn't know this was a state song. And he said, well, you should know it. I knew the words. We were all made to sing it. And they said, well, are you mad because it says that's where this old darkest heart and longed to go? No, that isn't what bothers me. You'd be surprised. Well, would you want to change that name? No, don't change that. I said, have you looked at the second stanza to the song, which says, even in death, the slave is saying, I can't wait to get back to old Massa and old Missus, and we can go to heaven, and we won't be separated no more. No, you won't be separated, but you will still be a slave, even
after
in heaven.
Death. Yeah.
Good God have mercy. How can a man be free when the ogre of bigotry pervades his every waking moment and then dances through his dreams for plaudits? You can't do it.
Let's talk to Lisa, calling from Alexandria. Lisa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you, Harold.
Sure.
I just want to say thank you, Governor.
Thank you, ma'am.
I appreciate you, and I'm going to buy your book,
good.
And I'm going to read the story. And I just thank you from the bottom of my heart for
thank you, ma'am.
Your courageousness and everything you've done to get us this far. Thank
well,
you.
You're mighty kind, and thank you very much, Lisa.
God
bless. Thank you so much, Lisa, for your phone call. And by the way, of course, the website will be posted on whur.com after the program. It's sonofvirginia.com, and there will be updates throughout this week and this month where the governor will be making appearances to sign the book. I don't endorse stuff, but I will say I have a signed copy, so I would recommend that you find a way to procure a copy.
Can I say something, Harold, before we end it up? One of the things I want to point out in this book that I try to point out is that I want people to become involved in the decision-making process. I call it the polity. Rather than to ask others to, well, why did this take place? As I said to the gentleman who called earlier about the gentrification and the housing, et cetera, and the opportunities, someone has to make those decisions. A decision is made about what color the light is, how many people can be in a room, when you can cross the street, what sides of the road you drive on. Who makes those decisions? They are decisions that we can control if we involve ourselves. That's what I meant in the Ferguson situation. That's what I mean in any of the situations. If the police are not doing the job, then you do what? You get rid of the people who select the police. Yeah. And how do you do that? By voting.
I have 30 seconds. After you're gone, how would you like to be remembered?
I hope I'm not gone too quickly.
Oh, we hope
but
not either.
If I am
but we're
gone,
not all here to
I would
stay.
Like to yeah. be remembered as someone who did everything he could with what he had and had absolutely no regrets, and I'm very grateful for the opportunities that have come my way.
Governor Douglas Wilder, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you,
many more years, great health to you. Congratulations on the book, and continue to tell your story. We really appreciate
you. Thank you, sir. Enjoyed being with you.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, October 6th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me at hfisher@whur.com, on Facebook at Harold T. Fisher, or Twitter at hfisherwhur. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.